Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of the Indian Conflict Resolution Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jyoti M. Pathania, in conversation with Mr. Danjuma Mohammed from Nigeria. He's a scholar with more than 15 years of professional experience in the humanitarian and development field, specializing on climate change, peace, and security studies. He worked for various USAID-funded projects, collaborated with Search for Common Ground, Next Year SPD, an entrenching peace project in the Northeast Nigeria. He was also associated with the University of Amsterdam, wherein he focused on the role of non-state security groups for promoting peace in Nigeria. Danjuma has played a key role in the dialogue, mediation, and reconciliation efforts between farmers and herders in the Guyuk local government area of Adamawa State under the British Council project. He's been involved in initiatives to foster positive relations between herders and farmers in states such as Plateau, Benue, Nasarawa, and Kaduna. Currently, Danjuma is engaged in several consultancy services with the World Bank Group. Welcome, Danjuma, to the OIJ PCR podcast.
Thank you very much, Professor. It's my pleasure.
Great. How are you today and where are you speaking from?
Oh, thank you, Prof. I'm currently in Adamawa State, Jimeta specifically, which is the city center of Adamawa State in Nigeria. Yeah.
Okay, great. Before we dive into things, could you explain to us generally the ideas and frameworks of positive peace and community security networks that you have been so closely engaged with?
All right. Before I dive into the main conversation, first of all, I want to appreciate you for having me here. And generally speaking, when we talk about positive peace, the notion is usually being misconstrued by several individuals. Because to some people, peace is just where there is no war, when there's absence of war, that's what peace means to them. But positive peace entails that we go a little step further by ensuring that all the policies and practices that hampers communities from living in peace are being put into the right perception. That is to say, the judicial system must be functional, it must be accountable, and it must be transparent. So, and with the work we've been doing in the past, specifically the one we did with Entrenching Peace Network, we looked essentially at the role of both traditional and government institution in fostering peace. We look at the judicial angle, how to ensure that the judiciary is accountable when it comes to fostering peace within the community. So generally speaking, you know, the issue of positive peace is not actually a new concept, but people are really not imbibing it within the daily and normal routine of the peace building space. But it's very essential and it is key to ensuring a sustainable peace in every community or locality. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely well said. You know, as someone with first-hand experience in community capacity building, especially for violence prevention, broadly speaking, what do you believe should be the top priorities for the states in building a comprehensive, effective community security networks?
All right. I will first of all start by saying within the peace-building space, effort of the state should be concentrated on building synergy between and among critical stakeholders. And when we are talking about stakeholders, I would like to start from the perspective of Nigeria and its peculiarity. There is a lot of respect for our traditional leaders over here because they play a very key role in fostering community social cohesion and within the peace building domain generally. So I want us to lay more emphasis of building synergy between those actors and side by side, building the same kind of relationship, which is vertically between the traditional system and the state-owned security outfit, alongside some traditional security outfits, because we have several security outfits here that are non-state security group, but they provide an essential role in ensuring that peace is being restored in communities that has been affected, and they avert most of the conflict that was supposed to happen. So we call them hunters group, vigilante group, and they play a very critical role in securitization and in the peace building process. So I would like to advocate for an essentially inclusive peace building process that work within identified communities and emphasize on the role of vertical cohesion in all the peace building programs that we are having in Nigeria. And every stakeholder should be bridging the divide within their community. So when we have the traditional ruler working on one hand, the non-state security group and the state-owned security group, so they should work in synergy in terms of information provision, information gathering, intelligence gathering, and response to conflict situation. So it's very essential. And most of these things cannot be achieved if we don't have some five critical elements. I will start by saying, number one, the legal reform and the justice and legal sector should be reformed, and there should be improvement. Because I do believe, for one, that the severity of crime does not deter people from committing crime. Rather, it is the certainty of punishment. We've seen a lot of communities where people take and bear arm against their own community and they go scot-free. So it does not matter the number of people that was killed during the process. That will not stop them from committing a crime in the future. But rather, if it is certain through a very good legal and justice sector reform that those that are found culpable will definitely be punished for the crime they've committed, then it deters them from committing those crimes. So
right.
Apart from the legal reform, we'll talk about community engagement. So in doing that, community should be aware that there is an existing reform within the legal and justice sector, and there should be a kind of a community collaboration to understanding the new policies that are coming, such that they will use it as a kind of sensitization within their community to ensure that their words does not fall into the prey of being whipped by the horsewhip of the law. Thirdly, I will look at emergency response and preparedness. Though we have that role essentially being carried out by our security system, but the non-state security group has a very strong role to play because they have first-hand information about what is happening in the community, how they engage with others within other community, and they have first-hand information as compared to the state-owned security groups. For example, a local vigilante is domiciled within his locality. He understands the toughs and the terrain of the area. And when it comes to response and preparedness, he's better prepared than the state-owned security personnel that is being transferred from several kilometers to come and securitize those community. And I think that by doing that, it will lead us to the fourth strategy, which involves crime prevention strategy. And the crime prevention strategy will now synergize the emergency response and preparedness within the local security and the state policing plans. So when we have that, it should follow a diversive and inclusive process, such that when select members that will participate in those platforms, they should not be lopsided, because if you lopside the activity, it's definitely going to backfire against anybody.
Yeah, that's so 5 points you've given us with regard to comprehensive, effective community security, peace building networks. I get that. When you say non-state security groups, I assume that you are meaning the non-governmental groups, the groups which are perhaps not associated with the state. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So that brings me to my next question, where since you have participated, in the dialogues, mediation and reconciliation efforts between the farmers and the herders in the Guyuk local government area of your state, I want to know from you, what was the first step undertaken during the dialogue process? You know, how did you get the two conflicting parties to sit on the same table?
That's a very good question. You know, first of all, we tried by understanding the nature and dynamics of the conflict within the area. Secondly, we understood who are the actors, who are the spoilers within the area. Then we used a tripartite approach by number one, doing an intra-group dialogue, sorry, within a specific group. We are talking about farmers and herders. So
Right.
we did an intra-group dialogue with the farmers first. We
Okay.
followed it up with the herders and tried to understand what are the issues, what are the burning issues that they would never say outside within their confined space. Every community member or every ethnic group have their own peculiarity, the way they keep their own secrets, the way they discuss issues that is affecting them. So there are some things that will never be said outside. And one of the most secretive group is the herders group. They originally believe that if you are not an Aboriginal herder, you are not expected to have access to some very critical information about their modus operandi and what they do. So we got the intra-group dialogue to address those issues, outline those issues. Then we now have another second leg of intra-group dialogue by trying to, since we've identified what is obtainable from both sides, we now try to proceed it to the other group. Like for the farmers, we took it to the herders without them knowing that those issues were from the herders. And we start interrogating those issues and said, okay, what if, that's where the what if question comes. What if you said you want this and you cannot get it? What is the alternatives for you? So we got those facts from them, and we now went ahead and organized an intergroup dialogue whereby we bring the critical stakeholders from the farmer side and the herder side. They are not much in number. We just did 10-10, and we bring them into group. So initially, when we started, we made them sit apart. After a time, we give them tasks to accomplish together, and they get to understand each and every one of their issues. And we essentially bring on board women, youth, and persons with disability. And one of the key pointer was finding a person that has a form of disability. He cannot walk, and he was like, I think the problem that you are having in this community is because you don't really factor people like us into your decision. So it got them talking, and they begin to interact with each other. And after a time, they came into an agreement where they said, okay, we are going to provide X, Y, and Z for you so that you'll be able to operate freely. And in the last 7 years, there has been no known farmer herder conflict in Guyuk local government.
So, Danjuma, that's been a success story, that means. But what was the main issue
Absolutely.
between the farmers and the herders, if I may ask you?
So the major issue we are having is lack of understanding. The farmers don't understand the plight of the herders. The herders feel that the farmer is looking towards acquiring his own cattle. And we have, because of the porosity of the Sahelian region, we have a lot of organized crime, transnational banditry, cattle rustling in large scale and stuff like that, which is being perpetrated by some criminal elements. But the farmer feels that whenever a transhuman pastoralist is passing through their community, they are definitely looking for trouble because, climate change and environmental degradation has led to shrinking of rivers. It has led to a whole lot of devastating environmental effect that is reducing the space where both farmers and herders actually look for their source of livelihood. But both the farmers and herder community did not look into the environmental factor that has caused this issue. What they were actually looking at is, when your source of income shrinks, you become more aggressive. And when you are aggressive, definitely you want to just transfer the aggression to any next available person close to you. So they were really not looking at the environmental cost. For them, herders will definitely want to encroach into their farm to destroy. And herders too say, okay, farmers too want to steal their cattle. So it's been a whole lot of back and forth, and the trust is completely lost in the process because at every point in time, you see even top level political elites trying to wade into the issue, get some money out of the government, then they allow the issue to go like that. And a whole lot of factors is contributing to this. We have corruption on the one side, you have a whole lot of issues around. So the couple with the porosity of the Sahelian region, because Sahelian region is definitely the hottest bed for conflict now and breeding more conflict in the future. So most of those issues put together, it's not actually a straight thing. We have several and multiplicity of factors that is swelling of the crisis within those general area. So we
Okay.
identified and we engaged appropriately. So that was the niche for us that we were able to carve.
Okay, great. So you did with your initiatives help in fostering positive relations between the herders and farmers in your state. There were certain early warning and response mechanisms that perhaps you had used in your reconciliation efforts.
Okay, I will give you an example with two communities. One in a local government, there are two different local government, two communities sharing a boundary across the River Benue. So
Right.
what happened was that there was an early warning sign that a conflict is about to occur. So the main cause was when a farmer, a herder encroached into a farmer's land,
Right.
the herder got killed. And community members did not see anything. Everybody was silent about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. Security forces came and everybody pleaded anonymity to the death. So the herders in their droves were moving their community away from the exact community where the issue happened. And when the farmers were asking them, "Where are you guys moving to?" He said, "We don't." They said, "We don't know where we are moving to, but they say we should move." So they moved. And you see, that's an early warning sign for people that have lived in a community for over 50 years, just moving in the broad daylight, moving their things, moving their herds, moving their house, moving their families, and nobody is saying anything about that. The community went into relaxing, thinking, okay, there will be no more problems since they've left. Lo and behold, in the night, they attacked the community, killed over 150 people, and followed up with a reprisal attack after 1 week. The fatality was so much. And when government came into the issue, government did not look at the original, the cause of that conflict. They were just treating it at the surface level, which involves militarizing the community without really engaging community members and understanding what the root cause of the conflict is.
Right.
After 2 years, same conflict broke out again with
Okay.
almost a similar pattern of early warning of mass movement of migration. And whenever you see a herding community migrating away from their specific and determined migration, which includes, okay, when the weather is hot and when there is no enough water, they move down south to get a greener pasture where they can forage for their farm, but for their cattle. But at the heart of a rainy season, you see mass migration of herder down south or up north. It's a pointer. It's a very strong signal for anyone that something is about to happen. But because there is no trust and collaboration between those two communities, nobody is willing to take the bull by the horn and discuss about the mass migration. They were seeing it as normal. Same thing happened again after 2 years, and some numbers of people were killed. But in this time, the level, because the communities are now more, I would not want to use resilient. They were much more on the watch out to see probably something will happen. It was a very serious war between those communities. Both communities had fatalities, but government and institutional leaders don't really pay attention to the early warning signs. And I implemented an early warning project, which was a 4 years project. And what we did was to take on the first leg traditional leaders and key stakeholders within a community in seven LGAs, that's local government areas in Adamawa, seven LGAs, all the district heads and village heads. We trained them on early warning and early response. And we created a platform. We did not train and leave. We trained the police who are initially to respond and the civil defense. We trained them too on early warning and early response and created a platform that enables these two groups, these three groups, to interface and discuss the security architecture of their community. We
Right.
capture, we could meet a local government peace committee. And at the level of local government peace committee, you have all the district heads, all the divisional police officer, all the divisional officers of the civil defense, human rights activists, local NGOs that are working within the peace building space, people that are working on gender, people that are working on nutrition, and they were discussing critical issues. And for across all the seven LGAs in Adamawa State, and some in Borno, definitely four LGAs in Borno, then in Yobe, we have four LGAs too. Across all this community, critical stakeholders were trained in how to interface. But you know, the issue with the donor funding, whenever the funding cuts, Probably because of the incentive that comes with it in form of transport reimbursement, communities don't really see the need. They know that it's very essential, but they will not use it. They will definitely be waiting for an opportunity for another organization to come up and say, we want to do a similar project. And they will now take on and say, we are the initial originator of this within the community. You know, it's actually doing some kind of, you like we have empowered some people to take over the security architecture. But notwithstanding, the information that is being shared across those platforms were very useful and important to every community members. And they definitely understand how to track early warning signs and how to read them to make an informative decision.
Great. You know, you have conducted large portion of your work and research in the immensely diverse communities of Northern Africa. Now, South Asia and India specifically, you know, represents linguistically, culturally, and religiously a very heterogeneous and a complex society. So in your experience, how do these realities play into and impact the likelihood of conflict and approach to conflict prevention? So for instance, in your view, what do inclusive security network looks like? And you mentioned that, you know, it includes the youth, it includes the women. And so how do you see this gender inclusivity and gender responsiveness play out at various levels of peace building processes in the South Asian context and especially India?
Okay, thank you very much. I think there is a whole lot of similarities between the West, North Africa, and India. So we run a more patriarchal society where the plight of women are really not considered when it comes to decision making. Though at individual home level, they have their say, but when it comes to a collective community engagement, women are not really present there. Not to talk of persons with disability. So what I want to picture of an inclusive security network.
Yes.
So when we look at gender inclusivity and gender responsiveness and how it can play across different level of peace building. Number one, because of the similarity of the context between Africa and India, definitely most government policy are not gender responsive. And when we talk about gender responsiveness, we are looking at gender budgeting, changing gender norms. The way government perceive gender is all about the number of male and female. But when we talk about gender responsive budgeting, we are talking about what percentage of the budget goes to a particular gender, what percentage goes to a particular group, what percentage goes to persons with disability. So when we have communities where they are more patriarchal, because most of the government's decision makers are men, they have limited the role of women to homemaking and cooking, which is very derogatory because women play a very critical role in peace building process. I will tell you an example. When we're implementing an early warning project, we brought about some men groups into the platform. And when they begin to talk, it was so shocking and touching that women have more information than the men. Ask me why. Because men are busy chasing their daily source of sustenance and livelihood because they believe it's duty bound on them. So they allow their wives to stay at home with the kids. But every movement within the community, from the time that the father has left the house to when he returns in the evening, which is more productive time, the women studies the community, understands everybody that is moving in and out of that community, and probably what the notion of those people are. So during the early warning project, by the time we're training them, it was the woman that was actually giving us facts and figures that at exactly so time, some group of herders moved from X location to Y location. And why their men are not there? Because they are busy doing their things wherever they are working. So it is important that we include women in every decision making. And it was so fantastic that what the women came up with has led to a whole lot of policy change in Nigeria. We started as if we are just doing an early warning project. But you know that the group that we created, the women working group that was established, were the one that pushed for the enactment of violence against persons, violence against persons prohibition act. And it was being passed by the legislator because they understand that the women are more vulnerable to the men. So men tends to play their wives, whatever they were, but there was a law that was passed and it was very strong. And there is even a time to be served in prison for violating those laws. So it's very interesting when you work with women and trying to include them in decision-making process, the level of speed you gain and the level of achievement you can get within the shortest period possible.
That's
Thank you.
great. That's really very encouraging, to know that women are very active and forceful participants in any peace building processes that you were part of, and that they
Yes.
shared more information than the male counterparts. So that's really very interesting to know. Danjuma, as a peace builder and a strategic planner or as a researcher, how do you try to ensure that the short-term peace building measures or accomplishments are actually accompanied by long-term positive changing of values, attitudes, and the cultural norms? Because this takes a lot of time in changing the attitudes of the people and especially
Absolutely.
conflicting groups. So how do you ensure that? Are there some specific schemes, specific proposals, specific issues that you work on? Or you have a system wherein you recheck, whether that policy has been working. Is somebody accountable in this? So how does it work?
Okay, thank you very much. Peace building is not like making a coffee. Making a coffee is very easy. What you just need is a coffee and hot water, coffee set, then some cream possibly. So peace building involves a whole lot of peace, moving pieces of activities, be it social cohesion, community resilience, even at the initial level of trying to understand the nature, causes, and dynamics of conflict, stakeholders' engagement. So these are short-term activities that will eventually lead into a bucket of a long-term activity. What do you want to see? You need to have a baseline. When you have a baseline, what is obtainable, what is not, then you look at the bigger picture. I want a community whereby the rights of farmers and herders will be respected by both parties, for example. Then I say, okay, what can we do? By the time you begin to push at the initial stage that, okay, you should respect the right of one another, nobody listens to you. But you need to come up with a whole lot of activities. One, trust building activities. You need to come up with community cohesion activities, even resilience and coping mechanism in the face of several issues, in the face of environmental degradation, climate change, extreme weather conditions, even the economy is not that friendly. So what activity can bring these two people together? And they begin to foster relationship. When you foster relationship across communities that are divided with conflict, gradually you'll be moving the bits and pieces of those moving pieces and trickling it into the bigger bucket of the overall peace building activity. And at every point, for a peace building activity, you don't need a long time to do your evaluation. You can say, for example, after every 6 months, because the danger is if you don't do constant evaluation, I will give you an example and say a doctor can only kill a patient at a time. But a peace builder, if he wrongly diagnoses a conflict, he will wipe out an entire community with the simple mistake he has made. Do you agree with me? So you need to be moving those bits and pieces together and do constant evaluation to check what's working, what can be modified, what's not really working, what should be discarded. And generally, by not losing focus on the short, long-term accomplishment, with your short-term accomplishment, it's not easy for you to hatch your egg. Begin to count your chicks before they hatch. The example I gave about the farmer-herder conflict in Guyu, we've had 7 consistent years now, and there has been no known conflict between farmers and herders in the community just because of a simple thing, the engagement, even the caliber of people that we engage, the stakeholders that were engaged were those that actually have the capacity to convey. When you move into a community and say, okay, I want to do a peace building activity, there is every likelihood that your activities will be hijacked by some people that are not key decision makers. So
Okay.
understanding who the key decision makers is and trying to engage them appropriately, understanding their strengths and weaknesses and how you can leverage on those will make you an excellent long-term planner when it comes to the peace building space. So, and you have to constantly upgrade yourself with some research, try to understand the nuances around communities because, peace building activity is like a snowball. When it falls, it trickles to every other place. But when you narrow your work to a particular community, the effect of other communities that are not so peaceful will definitely erode the good work you have done within your community. So you keep focused, understand what is obtainable, and constantly evaluate your processes. That's what makes you a good peace builder. Thank you.
Great. So constant revaluation, Danjuma. That's right. Well,
Absolutely.
thank you so much. Danjuma, that was a first-hand information of peace-building activities and conflict resolution mechanisms. And it's good to know that the conflict between the herders and farmers in your state has been resolved and has been a success story by using various peacemaking activities and peace building activities, that you and your projects have been dealt with. So heartiest congratulations to you on that, and lots of learning for the South Asian community as well.
Thank
And
you.
it was indeed wonderful having spoken to you, and I'm sure this will be very insightful podcast, especially in the realm of peace and conflict resolution. Thank you so much
The
for your
pleasure is
time.
mine. Thank you very much, Prof. Thank you for having me.